Good morning, everybody. It's so good that you've come to our autumn study retreat. And I'm so happy to be here with you in the way that I can be. I can actually see you as I speak, in my heart, of course, and in my mind. But as I said in my note, which the Eno read to you last night, while it has always been my plan to be here at this retreat to give my talks, my health is still somewhat fragile, and I haven't really been given permission to attend the retreat, and I am very sorry for that. As some of you have heard me say, my teacher used to say that the Dharma talk is always going on. Sometimes it's with the sound of the wind, and sometimes it may be the wood crackling in the wood stove, and sometimes, I guess, it's the sound of a voice coming through these speakers. After all, the Dharma talk is what happens between what the body and the mind encounter and what the mind does during that encounter. So please know that it's my deepest wish that it was just me sitting here in the room with you physically. But we have what we have. And I'm grateful for that. In Zen, because of the constant constellation and reconstellation and reshuffling and moving around of all things, as a result of the truths of impermanence and codependent origination, that's the Buddhist phrase for interdependence, we say that there's no beginning and no end. And when you first hear a phrase like that, of course, it sounds like it contradicts the obvious fact that there are beginnings. And there are endings, or at least there appear to be. Most things appear to be just like the sentence that I'm saying right now. They seem to have a beginning, they seem to have a middle, and then at some point they seem to end, and everybody goes home, like it, you know, after the movie is over. But in order to have some fun with this idea of no beginning and no end, I thought it might be kind of nice to begin. See, there's the beginning. Thought it might be nice to begin our study retreat with some of the final words and the teachings that the Buddha offered at the end of his life. And this brief quote that I'm going to read to you is taken from the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the last days of the Buddha. We don't often get to study the Buddha's actual words together. I mean, actually, these aren't the Buddha's actual words. These are translations, but they're as close as we have. So I'm excited that we can study this together to begin our retreat. But before I read it, I need to make a disclaimer. I want to be sure you know that because of the content of what the Buddha starts out saying, that despite my recent medical situation, surgery, and recovery, I'm not using the Buddha's words here to slip in something under the door about myself. That would be kind of unfair of me. So just so we're clear, this is the Buddha talking about his life. It's not me talking about my life. So here we go. And he's talking to Ananda in this Parinibbana Sutra. Now I am frail, Ananda, old, aged, far gone in years. This is my 80th year. And my life is spent. You see why I made made that disclaimer, because I'm only 71. So now I am frail, Ananda, old, aged, far gone in years. This is my 80th year. It was the Buddha's last year, and my life is spent. Even as an old cart, Ananda, is held together with much difficulty, so the body of the Tathagata is kept going only with supports. It is, Ananda, only when the Tathagata, disregarding external objects, with the cessation of certain feelings, attains to and abides in the signless concentration of mind. I'll say it again. Attains to and abides in the signless concentration of mind, that his body is more comfortable. This quality of mind that the Buddha just referred to is what he means by the word supports. It is the support that comes from the concentrated quality of his mind that not only makes his body more comfortable, but keeps him going. Back to the Buddha. Therefore, Ananda, be islands unto yourselves, refuges unto yourselves, seeking no external refuge. With the Dharma as your island, the Dharma as your refuge, seeking no other refuge. And how, Ananda, is a bhikkhu an island unto himself? Bhikkhus are members of the Buddhist Sangha or community, so it could be himself or herself, because he was talking about both the men and the women in the Sangha. And how, Ananda, is a bhikkhu an island unto himself, a refuge unto himself, seeking no external refuge? With the Dharma as her island, the Dharma as her refuge, seeking no other refuge. When he dwells, contemplating the body in the body, earnestly, clearly comprehending, and mindfully, after having overcome desire and sorrow in regard to the world. This last phrase, after having overcome desire and sorrow in regard to the world, might prove troubling to some of you at this point, and might bear some real investigation, given the fact that we not only do have desires, and we wrestle with them on a daily basis, all people do, but that one of our desires is our bodhisattva desire and commitment to end suffering in the world. But the Buddha says, when he dwells, contemplating the body in the body, earnestly, clearly comprehending, and mindfully, after having overcome desire and sorrow in the world. When he dwells, contemplating feelings in feelings, and the mind in the mind, and mental objects in mental objects, earnestly, clearly comprehending, and mindfully, after having overcome desire and sorrow in regard to the world, then truly she is an island unto herself, a refuge unto herself, seeking no external refuge. Having the Dharma as his island, the Dharma as her refuge, seeking no other refuge. Those bhikkhus of mine, Ananda, who now or after I am gone, that's us, abide as an island unto themselves, as a refuge unto themselves, seeking no other refuge, having the Dharma as their island and refuge, seeking no other refuge. It is they who will become the highest. And here it comes, here's the final capping phrase, if they have the desire to learn. And we know that the supposed last words of the Buddha are in line with this teaching when he reportedly said, be a light unto yourself. So this also brings to mind the Zen phrase, which is an important pointer in our practice, that in order to allow the natural home of our sourceless source, our true home, to simply emerge, all we have to do is to take the step back inside, and allow our own natural inborn radiance to shine. And when it does shine, we no longer are caught or dwell in the passing thoughts and feelings and bodily sensations and external objects that usually occupy our attention, because our own natural radiance is like the sun that quietly shines through the hazy quality of those things. And we dwell in what we truly are, in our true nature. Or maybe I shouldn't say our true nature, just true nature, just this. So the Buddha was talking about those disciples in his Sangha, which was monastic in nature. But I think this teaching is perfect for our lives as householders, though we're often called lay people, but I prefer the word householder. He does not say, bhikkhus, you should go to a special sacred mountain or wear special beads or go to a particular monastery or go to some other place that reputedly has some special sacred ancient powers in order to find the Dharma and take refuge in the Dharma or in the people you find there. He says, go to you. Go to you yourself. Your true, and this is what yourself means, your true, whole, unconditioned, undistracted, undiluted, concentrated self, to the seeming island that you are, which is no different from the Dharma. All the Dharma is right there in what we are. That is the only place of refuge that there is. And that is where you will find it. I think this understanding is echoed so beautifully in the Zen story of Baijun, who was asked, "What is the most extraordinary thing?" And Baijun answered, "Oh, just to sit down on Mount Baijun. That's the most extraordinary thing." So just to sit on the mountain that he is, just to sit on the mountain, just to sit on the island, just to sit as the island that we are, that is sufficient. That is enough. That is the place of Dharma, the place of refuge. But it's not enough just to go there. The Buddha uses this other word, and it's essential to our practice and to how we bring it into our daily lives as householder practitioners. He says, only when the Tathagata, disregarding external objects with the cessation of certain feelings, attains to and abides in the signless concentration of mind, that his body is more comfortable. So there it is. Abides, dwells, lives in, stays in, makes as an abode, makes as a home to return to again and again and again on those occasions when we forget where we truly live. And it's reasonable, we can ask, what is that home? What does the Buddha tell us are the walls and the ceiling and the floor and the furnishings that make up that home? That place of refuge in the Dharma. It's right here. It is none other than the signless. Signless means unconditioned, undistracted, complete. It is none other than the signless concentration of mind. It is what in Zen we call shikantaza, just sitting. Just sitting with a concentration of mind that is without beginning or end. Just the effortless, concentrated awareness that we bring to the present moment. The moment that we call now. I want to say that Tathagata, which is a word that you may know is a Sanskrit word, of course, and it's one of the honorific names or titles for Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha. But Tathagata also means one who has thus gone and one who has thus come and also one who has come from thusness, which I think is the most useful understanding for us, one who has come from thusness. Who or what has not come from thusness? So the Buddha says, only when the Tathagata, disregarding external objects, with the cessation of certain feelings, attains to and abides in the signless concentration of mind, can we, who also come from and are never apart from thusness, in fact, cannot be separated from thusness. And despite all of the appearances and the various peregrinations and the kaleidoscopic, multiphasic, color-coded trips that we put ourselves through with our beautiful and very creative minds. But despite all of the wonderful things that the mind can do, and they are wonderful, of course, human creativity, only when the Tathagata, only when we abide in the signless, spacious, whole concentration of mind that is our birthright, can we dwell in the true refuge that the Dharma provides right here in these very lives of ours. And then, when we do, we know the most extraordinary thing, the miraculous, ordinary thing that we are, which when we make a study of it, turns out to be pretty extraordinary, all in all. And, admittedly, as you all know, pretty difficult to fully and truly realize. Far more difficult for us as householder practitioners, I want to say, than for those home leavers at the Buddha's time who walked away from home and family and jobs, walked away from worldly enticements and all the rest of it in order to study and practice with the Buddha. householder practice is much more difficult. And in some ways, I guess my view is that as hard as those people's lives were, and they were difficult, our lives are so comfortable that it may be harder for us to have this signless concentration of mind than it was for his bhikkhus. Now, when I was reading these words of the Buddha, I suggested that the phrase, quote, after having overcome desire and sorrow in regard to the world, might appear to be a challenge for us, especially given the bodhisattva vow in Mahayana Buddhism to stay here until all beings, all creatures, all sentient forms of life and sentient forms of life are liberated from suffering and the samsaric wheel of birth and death. And after all, good people in the Buddha's time and in every time, including ours, do experience the desire to end suffering for themselves, of course, and for others. So for themselves is like the in-breath, and for others is the exhale. And we do experience sorrow in regard to the world. How could we not look around, turn on the radio, or for those of you who have on the TV, or read the newspaper? So these are basic human feelings for anyone who's paying attention. And very often it is wrestling with these very feelings that bring people to spiritual practice. So what could the Buddha be saying? What is he asking us to do, and how should we go about it? Fortunately, the Buddha is a very straight talker. So right on the surface of this excerpt, where it can be seen by everyone and understood by everyone, he tells us, in order to maintain and abide in the quality and concentration of mind that will make the body more comfortable and the mind more comfortable, the feelings more comfortable, our relationship to the external world more comfortable, in order to maintain and abide in the quality and concentration of mind that will do that, one practices in such a way that we learn to disregard the pull of external objects. And we don't allow them to distract us or cause discomforting desires like greed or envy or jealousy or senses of not being or having enough. We don't allow those desires to arise. We practice and we live in such a way that what he calls certain feelings over time cease to arise. So again, any emotions that disturb the concentrated state of mind are not followed. We don't get into the narrative, and we don't get into engaging them. And I want to add that in time, by sincerely and wholeheartedly engaging the practice of not following, not running after, and not being pulled by those strong emotions, these feelings actually do, in time, lose power. And believe it or not, they can even cease to arise. And His Holiness the Dalai Lama has talked about that. And because the Buddha knows that his days are numbered, he's 80 and he sees what's going on. He doesn't want to waste time, so he gives Ananda the key to the practices by which this freedom can come about, this ability to dwell, to abide with the concentrated, signless concentration, excuse me, of mind. He tells Ananda, when a practitioner dwells in contemplating feelings in feelings, the mind in the mind, and contemplating mental objects in mental objects, earnestly, clearly comprehending, so not fooled by anything, and mindfully, so really present and attentive. So we know what things truly are from the shoot all the way back down to the root, and especially so that we know what we are. Then there is nothing. There is no object. There is no thought. There is no feeling. Even no sorrow for the world that can keep us from being a refuge unto ourselves. And once we do that, then of course it's only natural. It's just It's just in our nature that once we are able to realize that, do that in our own lives, these seeming islands that we are, it's only natural that we will do whatever we can to help others, to help all of life realize this freedom as well. So you can see how by following the method, the practices through which our lives and the Dharma become the refuge, the true home that we, and I believe all beings, have always wanted, these islands that we seem to be, we always think of islands as separate, but these islands actually study themselves so deeply that we learn one of the great paths of liberation, which nourishes and gives birth to the heart of the Bodhisattva. And so in the end, this island, this very one who carries our name, this person, this one we call me, is revealed as the very ground of discernment, love, and compassion that the world so desperately needs. Now, excuse me. I think it's fine to say that we should contemplate the body in the body and contemplate the mind in the mind and contemplate feelings in feelings and follow this kind of method. But people may not know how to do that. It is a practice. And there are many ways to go about it. Of course, what the Buddha is suggesting is that because we know that there is no permanent, ever-existent self of anything, whether it's the physical form or feelings or thoughts or sensations or our inclinations or even any kind of awareness that we may have, as talks about in the Heart Sutra, because we know that that everything is made of non-self elements. It's because of all the non-self elements that constellate that everything exists, because we know that. Because, as I've said before, in talks and in retreats with you, because the scientists are also coming to realize and be able to quantify, to put numbers and names on the non-self elements of things, which explains how things come into existence. When the Buddha is talking about contemplating the body in the body, the mind in the mind, feelings in feelings, etc., he's talking about looking with a Buddha's eyes, looking the way a Buddha looks. And a Buddha always remembers the truth of impermanence, which keeps things turning and returning. And a Buddha always remembers the truth of interdependence as well. So he's suggesting that we look from the surface all the way through what things actually are, not just what they appear to be, to see the real nature of what things are in external objects, for example, or in our thoughts or feelings. So because, before we begin the study exercise that I have in mind, I just want to give you an example of how to contemplate the thing that we find most readily. The thing that's usually the hot button ticket, which is our emotions, feelings. How to contemplate a feeling in a feeling in a way that's in the spirit of what the Buddha is talking about. And this method was taught to me by Vietnamese Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh. And I have used it. I've used it at times in my life when I really needed some insight into what was causing real pain or real confusion. And I've found that it's a very good contemplative approach, and so I want to just sort of see if I can let you know what the Buddha might be talking about. And if you try it with any feeling, it doesn't matter. It will help you to trace the feeling that you're experiencing. And it's especially good when it's really sort of, you know, something that's really bugging you. That will help you to trace that feeling from the surface experience of it that you're having in the moment, all the way back through its non-self elements, through the things that make that feeling, whether it's a love or a hatred or envy or jealousy or anger or peace, or it doesn't matter what it is. It'll help you to trace that feeling to its source. And in so doing, it also will show you all those elements that go into creating a feeling, no matter how powerful the feeling may be. And so I think this is a very useful approach. I want to remind you that that the reason the Buddha asks us to do this is so that we are no longer distracted. We're no longer conditioned. We're no longer pulled away from that place that he calls the signless concentration of mind, which is where we find the greatest refuge in the Dharma that we are. And so it isn't just a matter of, you know, feeling better in your life. Or another way to say it is that it's a way to no longer be controlled by all of the various ways that human beings are uncomfortable, or on the continuum from uncomfortable to real suffering. When, as the Buddha says, when we're able to abide in the signless concentration of mind, then things are better. It's the best. Excuse me. It's the best way to say it. Then we can really touch the self, and we can really touch the nature of life as it truly is. We can really go home. So here is one way to approach contemplating feelings in feelings. The first thing that we want to do is we want to to make sure that we won't be distracted, so we get away from the telephone. We go off to a place by ourselves so that we can really give ourselves the gift of our full and true attention. And once you find a place like that, maybe you have a place in your home, or maybe you need to go sit in the woods somewhere, if you have that. Although it can be done anywhere, it's better if you're not distracted, is the only point. And then you quietly inside yourself sit your body down. So you sit down and you make sure that you're in a comfortable position. For some it may be in zazen. For others you may just sit comfortably with your hands in your lap, or any way that you're comfortable, but you want to make sure that you can breathe easily and comfortably, because breathing is a part of our contemplation. It is part of the meditative practice that helps us to see what things really are. So in this case, we'll call it a feeling, something that we feel. So you take a comfortable position. Make sure that, you know, if your belt is too tight, loosen your belt. And then you can close your eyes. I know that during zazen we sit with our eyes with a soft gaze, but for this exercise you can close your eyes, or, you know, you can practice the soft gaze if you like, it's okay. This is very much like taking the backward step, taking the step back and going inside. And so you begin to breathe just quietly. Just notice your breath, contact your breath, so breathing in. You experience breathing in, breathing out. You experience breathing out. And you do that a few times. Each person will be different. And after a short amount of time, you let yourself put some words to the breathing. And you make sure that you're really present and aware of what's going on inside of you. And so you say to yourself, breathing in, I know that I am breathing in. And breathing out, I know that I am breathing out. And breathing in, I know I'm breathing in. Breathing out, I know I'm breathing out. Now, because that's a lot of words, you can then, once you establish that that's what you're doing, that you're bringing your attention to what's actually going on in your body. In this way, you're bringing your body and mind together. Then you can shorten it on the in-breath, in, on the exhale, out. In-breath, in, exhale, out. And then once you establish that, it doesn't take too long usually to establish that, you then can let yourself start to feel the feeling that you have. So let's say, let's say you're angry. Anger is, of course, one of the hottest feelings. Though the truth is that almost any feeling can be really sharp in that way. And so once you are aligned with your breath, breathing in and breathing out, you can say, breathing in, I know that I am angry. Breathing out, I know that I am angry. So you name it, you really honestly name it. This is no time to hide. You tell the truth. Because you're speaking to the deepest part of yourself who wants to help you. And you've come to the Bodhisattva. You've come to the right place. And right now the Bodhisattva knows that she or he is feeling angry. Breathing in, I know I'm angry. Breathing out, I know I'm angry. Breathing in, I know I'm really angry. And breathing out, I know I'm really angry. And you can drop the breathing in and breathing out part and just let the breath go in and you can say, angry. On the exhale, angry. Inhale, really angry. Really angry. And then begins the process of a deconstellation. Of that seeming solid emotion, in this case called anger. And you start with what you believe is the cause of the anger. Breathing in. I'm angry because he said that. Breathing out. I'm angry because he said that. And you do that a few times. Breathing in. I'm angry because he said that. Angry because she said that. And then starts the questioning that will really help you move down to the source of what's going on, the non-self elements of anger. So then breathing in. When he said that, it made me angry because... And you have to trust whatever your mind gives you. Exhale. When he said that, I'm angry because... It makes me feel X. Maybe dismissed or unseen or unworthy or could be anything. So I'm angry because when he said that, it made me feel this. And then the next step is, and why did that make you feel angry? So you say, breathing in. And that makes me angry because it makes me feel Y or Z. Breathing out, that makes me angry because it makes me feel Y or Z. So now you have a new name, and you've discovered that from the surface anger, there's something a little below it. And then you ask the next question. And that makes me angry because when I feel Y or Z, it makes me feel, and then you name that. And you stay with it on the breath, breathing in. When I feel Y or Z, that makes me feel, maybe it's scared. And you stay with that. And when I feel scared, that makes me feel angry because I feel unsafe. You trust whatever comes. Or it reminds me of when I was little. Okay, now you have another non-self element of that seeming solid emotion called anger. And you breathe in on that. And you breathe out with that. And you keep going. And when I feel like I was when I was little, it makes me angry because I feel so vulnerable. I don't want to be that vulnerable, etc. Breathing in. You breathe it out a couple of times. And then you keep going. And when I feel that vulnerable, that makes me angry because, you know, maybe it's anything might happen to me or someone might hurt me or, you know, and we go on. You just keep going on and on and on. And in this way, you are contemplating the feeling in the feeling. So you stay with the feeling and you let yourself feel the feelings that make the feelings. And you let yourself know the thoughts and the thought process that goes in to making the feeling, the feeling. And when you do that, you follow it all the way down and you don't stop until you get to the point where you are able to really identify the root of what that emotion, out of which that emotion comes. So I hope that's a good enough, clear enough explanation for Thich Nhat Hanh's approach to contemplating a feeling and a feeling. Adjust it, adapt it to however you need. But basically it's a constant and progressive questioning that takes you deeper and deeper and deeper through the non-self elements, and hopefully to the source. And you may be surprised what you find way down at the bottom of any emotion. You may be very, very surprised. I hope it's a pleasant surprise. It may not seem like it could be, but we shouldn't rule out any possibility.